Talking history on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony opening. Because in tonight's show, we're celebrating the life and music of Beethoven on this, the 250th anniversary of his birth. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just send us a text on 53106. Text costs 30 cents. Or you can email us, talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we discussed the birth of the border, the invention of stealth technology, and the life and world of Vincent van Gogh in our monthly book show. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life and music of Beethoven. Born in Bonn in 1770, Ludwig van Beethoven is one of the most famous composers in world history and undoubtedly one of the greatest. He's also perhaps the most iconic, and he changed forever the world of music. Despite severe problems with his hearing, Beethoven continued to compose some of the most passionate and powerful pieces of music, and at his death in 1827 left an incredible output of symphonies, string quartets, piano music, and many other pieces, including one opera. Beethoven is a cultural hero, an instantly recognised image, and someone who epitomises the idea of the artist as hero. The writer Victor Hugo has suggested that in Beethoven's music, the dreamer will recognise his dreams, the sailor his storms, and the wolf his forests. And so in tonight's show, we want to discuss the man, the myth, and most importantly, the music. And we also want to find out how COVID-19 has affected everything that was planned to commemorate the 250th anniversary of his birth. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Wolfgang Marx is a renowned historical musicologist and lectures in the School of Music at University College Dublin. And he's our resident music expert whenever we have a show on a classical composer. Dr. Michael Lee is a leading cultural musicologist, as well as a lecturer, writer, broadcaster and editor, and he teaches at the Department of Music in Trinity College Dublin. George Fleeton has taught opera, cinema, literature and theatre studies in higher education north and south, particularly at Queen's University Belfast. He's an independent promoter, producer and presenter, and is also the former director of the Northern Ireland Annual Opera Fringe Festival, and he's an associate with Lyric Opera Productions. Simon Taylor is the chief executive of the National Concert Hall in Dublin, and he's been praised by Minister Catherine Martin for contributing so much to the music sector throughout his career, both in Ireland and overseas, and for leading the National Concert Hall with distinction. Well, you're all very welcome. And Simon, I might begin with you, because tonight's show was meant to have been taking place in June. It was meant to have been taking place in the National Concert Hall, and it was meant to be taking place with lots of live musicians and composers playing the pieces. And COVID-19 has disrupted that idea. It's disrupted so much that was planned for Beethoven 250, both in Ireland and around the world. And I was wondering, could you maybe tell our listeners about just how disruptive the impact of the pandemic has been?
Well, thank you, and good evening. It's lovely to be talking to you. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, we had enormous plans for Beethoven this year, right through the year, but particularly for the autumn, and maybe yet we'll be able to do some of those, at least online, if not in person. And we did manage to get a few things in the early part of the year, just before COVID struck, including performances of, you mentioned, Beethoven's only opera, Fidelio. We did have two performances of those with Lyric Opera in the National Concert Hall in February, so it was great to get that done. But obviously, all around the world, this would have been a huge celebration of Beethoven this year. So it's quite extraordinary. You know, years of planning goes into these things, and much of it now not happening. From our point of view, yes, it would have been fantastic to have this program live in the National Concert Hall, and we should have been also just launching 2 weekends ago into the complete cycle of Beethoven string quartets on Sunday afternoons. And unfortunately, those at the moment are gone, although we're hoping that if restrictions in Dublin can be eased a little bit between now and Christmas, we still might manage to get some or all of those concerts in. Beethoven string quartets, of course, are the pinnacle of the string quartet repertoire, and we were featuring 8 different groups performing the complete cycle. So it would be wonderful if we could still do that.
And how devastating has this been for musicians and those whose whole livelihood depends on being able to work?
Well, I think it's absolutely devastating is exactly the right word. And ironically, in a way, it's the top pinnacle musicians that are most effective, because they would be people who generally earn their living solely out of performing. You know, obviously a certain amount of teaching is still continuing and a certain amount of performance online, but for most classical artists who depend on live concert giving, it's been quite extraordinary. I mean, I've spoken to a couple of colleagues recently, you know, very eminent international artists who've gone from maybe doing, you know, 100 concerts over the last 6 months to doing absolutely none in live. So, you know, one does worry for the future in terms of how long this is going to go on and where it's going to leave them.
Wolfgang, we've seen entire festivals that were organised around the commemoration having to cancel. We've seen some recitals online, but there has been a massive disruption.
Yes, indeed, it has. And it's actually heartbreaking to see how it's not just Beethoven, of course, it's everything. And it's not just classical music, it's also general things like no electric picnic, no longitude, no nothing. And I know quite a few people. Of course, the people who are best known, the international stars, are affected, but also the local musicians are affected. Lots of people who make their living singing at weddings and funerals and gigs of this and that and the other sort. And they're all struggling. And lots of people will most likely end up doing something else entirely. This is a life-changing experience for everybody. So I think I try to support things by buying tickets, for instance, or buying CDs when I can. I was yesterday, actually, Simon probably watched it too, or certainly, where there was a new piece performed from live streamed from the National Concert Hall. And I think that's something that all of us and all of our listeners as well might support. Support your local musicians, support other musicians where you can. And this is not just listening to live streams for free, which is what we are all used to. We go for what's cheap, but it would also great if we can, and if we are unable to support musicians by supporting them financially a bit wherever it's possible.
Oh, no, I agree completely with that. And Wolfgang, is there a challenge in trying to commemorate the 250th anniversary of the birth of a composer who we almost feel we know very well, because there is this image of him as this artistic hero who struggled against all of these problems, the loss of his hearing. And there are some pieces of music of his that we almost have overheard because they're played so regularly. Is there a danger in trying to approach it and say something new?
Yeah, there is certainly a risk of that. If it's a lesser known figure, you might dig deep and find a new piece even, or find new sources that were unknown that tell us a little bit more about the life of the person. Here it's very, very difficult, because even if there is no centenary or no anniversary, there's always someone working on Beethoven. And what people do, and I read a bit now in preparation for this, about what's been published, there's not so much new insights, new findings. It's about how can our time get a new view of the character from our particular point of view. There's, for instance, one book just that I read by Laura Tunbridge, who is a lecturer in Manchester, A Life in 9 Pieces, Beethoven, A Life in 9 Pieces, where she looks at the different aspects of his life, and she connects each of these aspects with one piece and sort of goes chronologically through the life, talking about success, friends, heroism, ambition, love, liberty, family, spirit, and endings. And that's quite interesting, because there's also bits in there that we normally don't necessarily know that much, not just about the person, but the context. For instance, about the inflation, the rampant inflation that Vienna experienced during the Napoleonic Wars and how difficult it was to make a living, that's something that might also relate to today. So Beethoven was never starving, but he had a pension from for a number of years from three of his members of the nobility who were supporters of his. And that was actually nominally quite a large sum. But the moment he started receiving it in paper currency that they had introduced to cope with the economic situation, it started to become worth less and less. And so eventually it was not that much that he could. So he tried to convince them to give it to them in some other way. But people had to struggle there as well. And that's maybe a link that we can make to that period.
Michael, I'm very interested in how Beethoven was perceived in his own lifetime and ever since, because there is this very powerful image of Beethoven that we have. And I wonder how much of that is rooted in the reality, how much of it was part of the myth-making that accompanied him in his lifetime and that was built on afterwards. And is it possible to separate the two now?
Patrick, hello, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. And there are lots of different ways that you can approach something like that. I mean, obviously, a lot of the myth-making happened after Beethoven's death with the discovery of all these important documents, most notably, of course, the Heiligenstadt Testament, which we might have a chance to talk about. But even during Beethoven's lifetime, there are some really interesting things that start to emerge. I mean, you were playing a little extract there from Beethoven's Fifth Symphony there at the opening of the program. And, of course, a few years after Beethoven composed that, we see an extraordinary review emerge of that symphony written by the great German writer E.T.A. Hoffmann. Of course, and he couches his discussion of this symphony in terms of the philosophy of the sublime and the beautiful of Kant and the great German philosophical discourse that was happening at the time, and he's he's saying things like Beethoven's music sets in motion terror, fear, horror, pain, and awakens the infinite yearning that is the essence of romanticism. And of course, that was possibly the greatest of all rave reviews. And it really did make this argument for the people of Hoffmann's time, of the readers of 1810, that they should really perhaps reassess their view of this strange man in Vienna and pay a little bit more attention. And clearly that was something that Hoffmann was very eager to achieve. And it certainly did begin this certain tradition, this view of Beethoven, in which his music was seeming to reflect wider issues of the time.
And maybe we should talk now about that testament from 1802, because that does seem to establish the truth of this idea of the hero, the artist as hero, because he was suffering from increasing deafness, considering suicide, but determined to carry on and determined to do what was necessary to create these works of art that he was so determined to do.
Absolutely. I mean, the Heiligenstadt Testament is kind of it's many things. It's sort of a suicide note that was never delivered, and it was only sort of discovered in amongst his papers after he died. But it dates from that period in 1802 when he spent a few months outside of Vienna in a nearby village called Heiligenstadt. And already he's aware that his listening is becoming worse, and he's really worried about the prospect of deafness. And so he writes this letter to his younger brothers. I'll read a little bit of it if you like. I mean,
oh,
it's
yes,
wonderfully writing. And so he's saying, I must live quite alone, like an outcast. What humiliation for me. when someone standing near me heard a flute in the distance and I heard nothing. Or someone heard the shepherd singing and again, I heard nothing. Such incidents made me almost to despair. A little more and I would have ended my life. Only art held me back. It seemed to me impossible to leave the world until I had produced all that I felt was within me. And so I spared this wretched life, truly wretched for so susceptible a body, by which a sudden change can reduce me from the best condition to the very worst. So basically, it's almost, you almost get the impression that writing this was almost like a kind of a healing process itself.
Very good.
I will do what I can and struggle through. And as you say, become the artist. This idea of the artist as hero is very strong here.
George, we'll be talking to you later about the production of Fidelio and indeed Fidelio as one of his great masterpieces. And I know you were hugely involved in that February production that Simon mentions. But I was reading the article that you wrote for that production, and you had a wonderful line in it where you called Beethoven the most original spirit in the European musical world of 200 years ago, and talked about how his orchestral and instrumental music had so much power and glory. What is it about his music that resonated at the time and that still continues to resonate?
Thank you, Patrick. As you said yourself, Beethoven changed music forever. He was classical music's most difficult and complex character as a composer. And that affliction of becoming increasingly and incurably deaf over the final 30 years of his life is a principal ingredient of everything that he has left us. He claimed at one point in a letter to hear music in his world of deafness that no one else could hear. And so he set out almost as if it were a vocation to write it down for us. And we, of course, are fortunate because of that. And I always feel that if the effort of composing, he was trying to address full on his affliction of deafness, the music then becomes very special. I don't like to use the word unique, but it could be used in this sense, and very effective for his listeners. As we with the 9 symphonies, the 5 piano concertos, and all those other things, they were all a struggle. Beethoven was not a natural, happy, instantaneous composer like Mozart. Mozart had it all in his head already, and then the effort was simply just writing it down. Beethoven had to tear the music out of himself on what was a journey from darkness into light. And if we listen to anything that he wrote, all of that struggle is there in his music. My students used to ask me, what sort of a person was he if you met him in the street? And I think there's no biography that leaves out some of the following descriptives of the sort of man he was. He was a tortured soul. He was a lonely, unsettled, intolerant, overbearing, high-handed, irritable man. God knows we've met plenty of those. And his supreme, sublime innovations in music seldom brought him release or comfort from his afflictions, nor indeed did he have much acknowledgement or applause in his own lifetime. I used to sum it all up by saying, put simply, Beethoven's music is his autobiography and the piano is his voice.
Beautifully put, George. And Wolfgang, it's interesting that the piano was his voice, because I think we're going to go now to one of those piano pieces, one of his piano sonatas. Could you maybe introduce it for our listeners?
Yeah, this is the beginning of the Pathetique Sonata, which is one of his earlier sonatas, written just before, in his breakthrough period, when he sort of came into his own and developed his own style as a composer in the late 1790s. He was a student of Haydn for a few years, But then he developed his own voice. And as Michael said earlier, he has these romantic, he straddles both the classical style and the romantic style. In him, there is this transition from one to the other. And we can hear that in this music, how the romanticism comes through. So he still follows in broad terms the stylistic norms of the classical period of Mozart and Haydn. But he has this emotional impact in there and this broody, moody sense that comes through, and there's this struggle that you can hear in it, and that sort of breaks through and is inevitably then pushing everything along.
History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we commemorate the 250th anniversary of the birth of Beethoven. I'm joined by Professor Wolfgang Marx, Dr. Michael Lee, George Fleeton, and Simon Taylor. Wolfgang, one of the things that people are always interested in are these named works, things like the Moonlight Sonata. We heard the Pathetique there, the Third Symphony, named the Eroica. But very often it wasn't Beethoven who gave the works these titles. And in a way, there's a whole imagery associated works that is probably completely undeserved.
Yes, it's indeed in this case as well. Beethoven didn't himself name this the Pathetique Sonata. It was his publisher who published it under the title Grand Sonata Pathetique. So like the other famous Pathetique piece, Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, it was also not Tchaikovsky who named it that. It was his brother in this case, at least close enough maybe. But yeah, that is actually very common when you talk about classical pieces and their nicknames, so to speak. In the vast majority of cases, it wasn't the composer who named it. All these Haydn symphonies, the hen, the bear, and the philosopher and all that kind of stuff. No, it's very common that they acquire these nicknames reasonably soon after being published, but it's not the composer who does that. It's usually someone who wants to push it, like a publisher, maybe a reviewer, something like that.
And was he a political composer? Was he interested in politics? The story's always told that he was dedicating the Third Symphony to Napoleon, but then when he discovered that he'd made himself emperor, he marked out the inscription. Was he political?
He certainly was political. He grew up during the time just before the French Revolution, when intellectuals sort of could develop an interest and were actually, by and large, initially supportive if they weren't members of the nobility negatively affected by it. And he certainly was. That we can see that in, of course, the Ode to Joy, that he eventually, after 30 years of thinking about it, found a way of setting in the Ninth Symphony. But the other one is, yes, as you said, the Third Symphony, but also the opera Fidelio that we'll talk about in a moment and hear some music from. So he certainly was interested in the So emancipation, as it were, of the bourgeoisie. He saw himself as someone who is just as worthy as all these people who were worthy by birth. And he interacted with all those princes and counts and other people who supported him eye to eye, at least from his point of view. And he found people who actually let him do that. And when later, after 1815, when the reaction came, when the Metternich state was established, it was, of course, more difficult for people like him or Schubert or other composers and writers. But I think he kept this he had this belief, and it comes through again in his Ninth Symphony then at the end.
Very good. George, on Fidelio, an opera that I know you're passionate about, you do see very strong political messages there. And one production I saw of it very much had a modern day staging for it, which worked very well because of the themes that are that are so evident in it.
He was a political animal during the period when he was writing. And the opera Fidelio, which I think is incorrectly referred to as an opera, is his only because...
Now we're having
a... ...with things that they're...
Yeah, no apologies, George. We are having, and apologies to our listeners, we are having problems with the connection there. What we'll do is we will play a short extract from Fidelio, and when we come back, we'll be on a stronger line with George. Beethoven's Fidelio. George, sorry, we were having trouble with our line there.
Yes.
So tell us about Fidelio.
Fidelio, as I was saying a moment ago, is his only completed opera. He did dabble with other things. And it was, when I mentioned earlier, struggle, this was one of the biggest struggles of his compositional career. He wrote three overtures. It had passed through three or four different forms between 1804 and 1814. The version that we used in February in the concert hall was, of course, the final complete 1814 version of the opera. It is a political piece. It's what you might call a very serious opera. There's no laughs in it. It's not a comedy, and yet in one sense, no one dies in the opera, and it has that sort of impetus carried forward. It's an opera in two parts. The first part seems to be, I remember seeing it one time and saying, am I in the right place? Is this the right opera? This is not what I was expecting. And the second act then, when the introduction of Florestan, who is the imprisoned political prisoner, then it almost becomes a completely different piece of work. There are two pieces in Act One, which I think everyone will know, one more than the other. The Prisoner's Chorus, which comes in very near the end of the act. But that little clip that you played there is from the quartet in the form of a canon, in which each voice in succession, the second soprano, the first soprano, the bass and the tenor, enter and overlap with the previous voice. And each sings eight bars, and the simple melody therefore is repeated four times as the piece builds. But when you see it on stage, this looks very simple. It is actually very difficult to produce credibly on stage. They're not singing to or at each other, which is what you expect in opera, but rather each of the four voices is a theatrical aside, thinking aloud, revealing innermost thoughts, yet sharing the same music. And I think, for my money, it is the most beautiful piece of the entire opera. Fidelio hasn't had a great... there is fantastic interest in it, of course, this year. But you would have struggled in previous years and in my lifetime to find a production of it anywhere. We were very pleased in February to be involved with what became, but not because of COVID, the only production fully staged of Fidelio in Ireland this year. And I'm sure lots of productions have been knocked sideways across Europe and elsewhere by the by this pandemic. But Fidelio is something to treasure in that it is, and again, I don't want the word to use the word unique, but it is exceptional among everything else that that Beethoven wrote. Was he a natural operatic composer? By no means, because the struggle lasted 10 years. But I think he got there in the end. He got his political message about injustice, about the tyranny and so on, which is evident from the prison governor and whatnot. He got all that across very well. And there may be a mismatch between that political message and the music. So if you're not too interested in politics, you can sit before Fidelio and really enjoy it as a narrative. It's a rescue opera. His wife disguises herself as a prison guard to get close to him, hoping that she will find him alive, and she does. And there is of a sort of a happy ending, but the music throughout is sublime, especially in the second act.
Wolfgang, it's interesting there, George mentioned the prisoner's chorus. At one time in your life, you were one of those prisoners.
Yes, indeed. When I had just finished my Leaving Cert in Germany, I joined the chorus as an extra in my hometown of Bremerhaven in northern Germany. And that year they did Fidelio. So I turned out to be the 11th prisoner. We had all had to crawl out of four holes around the stage. And unfortunately, only the first two get the solo lines, or maybe fortunately for the audience. But it was great fun to experience it that way.
And Michael, I think you also have sung Fidelio.
Indeed. Yes, like Wolfgang, I have also sung in the prisoner's chorus, I'm honoured to say. This was in a production in Kilmainham Jail that was staged there in 2006 with Opera Theatre Company. So we each came out of our individual cell and emerged, having sat there in the cold dark through the whole first scene. So it was certainly a very atmospheric production.
It was indeed. I saw that and was incredibly impressive.
And Michael, can I ask you about the Beethoven sound and how it evolved over the course of his career? And I think sometimes people like to divide his career into early, middle and late period. But if you were to look at some of, say, the later works, the later piano sonatas, the later string quartets, the sound was very radical, very disruptive, very different from what audiences would have been used to at that time. And even now can be somewhat jarring and overwhelming, even as you get swept away by the beauty and power of it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you listen to something like his very late string quartets, you're entering into a sound world which is very challenging, even for listeners today. He really was taking quite an experimental approach to ideas of tonality, but also just to ideas of time and proportion. I think with Beethoven, he was always very fundamentally very interested in the nature of sound itself. I mean, even to something as basic as the simple drum taps that open the violin, there's this kind of ability to...
Sorry, again, problems there with the line. Simon, I might go to you, and looking at that output and looking at, say, something like the later string quartets or the later piano sonatas, it's quite clear that with Beethoven, there was a huge, not evolution, but this was a composer who was growing all the time and who was prepared to be experimental, and I suppose culminating in that Ninth Symphony when, in that fourth movement, it breaks into song, that it was almost as if he had shattered the confines of what was possible and was determined to do something new.
Yeah, I mean, it's been referred to earlier on that, you know, his music is his autobiography, and certainly that's absolutely true. You can hear throughout his career how he changed completely and how he changed music completely. And the late string quartets are perhaps the best example of that, where he's moved the whole string quartet genre so far from what he would have heard and learned from Haydn or Mozart, you know, 20, 30 years previously. And the composers and musicians of the day were thoroughly baffled by them at the time. You know, maybe it was because of his deafness in a way that he was very much in his own world and felt that here he was writing music, I suppose, fundamentally for himself and perhaps not worrying that they weren't understood. I mean, he quite clearly said himself that they weren't going to be understood now, but they would be by later generations. And I know Stravinsky referred to, I think it was the Große Fuge, referred to it in the early 20th century as a contemporary piece. So even, 100 years later, composers were already still thinking of this is contemporary music. This is music that's never really going to be other than contemporary. And likewise, in the Ninth Symphony, it must have been an extraordinary surprise to audiences at the time, suddenly this chorus joining in a symphony. So he was certainly not afraid to do things that were absolutely groundbreaking. And that was his character very much, too, I think.
And it's interesting, we've talked about his work almost being his autobiography, the stories of his struggles and his conflicts. But I wonder when we listen to it that one of the reasons why it resonates so much is that we're not really listening to Beethoven's struggles. We're hearing our own life struggles being reflected there, because it's all the turmoil that we are experiencing ourselves. It's the ups and downs of our lives. It's the conflicts. It's the attempt to resolve them and to come through them. And that, in a way, it's our autobiographies that we're hearing as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, if you listen to some of those late string quartets, particularly if you hear them live in an intimate setting, they're incredibly visceral. You can see the struggle that the performers have to really communicate the music, and it really brings you into it. It's intensely personal music, I suppose. And you're quite right. Yes, it does reflect the struggles that everybody has in life. And Beethoven, I suppose, was the first composer to really wear his heart on his sleeve from that point of view. That he saw himself very much as that artist struggling against fate in a way that really nobody before had seen themselves in quite the same way.
And Simon, I think you've selected a piece from one of those string quartets for us to play tonight.
Yes, indeed. This is the cavatina from one of the late string quartets, Opus 130. And, it's impossible listening to this music not to think of this very ill, I suppose not old, we would think of him as middle-aged these days, but he certainly at that stage was probably an old man in terms of his health, not just his deafness, but his general health. And here he is writing these string quartets, profoundly deaf, and writing music that, is desolate, I think, is what you'd say about this. I mean, it really is heart-rending stuff.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we celebrate and commemorate the music of Beethoven. It is, of course, the 250th anniversary of the birth of the great composer. I'm joined by Wolfgang Marx, Michael Lee, George Fleeton, and Simon Taylor. George, when we think about the image of Beethoven, it seems that there's an awful lot that's based on reality there. And is, I suppose, the disruption that you see in his life that's also reflected in the approach we see with the music?
Yes, Patrick. Your series prides itself in exploring the human side of history. And I think nothing exemplifies the human side of Beethoven than one of them has already been referred to this evening, the two letters he seems never to have sent and which were found in a secret drawer in his writing desk after his death in 1827. Now, the first of these was the Heiligenstadt document, testament, which has already been mentioned. But I'm more fascinated by the second one. It was a 10-page love letter written in pencil in around 1812 to an unnamed woman who may have returned Beethoven's love, but is referred to only as the immortal beloved and addressed in the opening sentence of the letter as, quotation, "my angel, my all, my very self." Now this, if I may, is the non-musical side of Beethoven's life. This is the almost the social, the human history of the man. There is no evidence extant to confirm or even to suggest who the immortal beloved was, and the market is full of books with dozens of theories as to who she was, the immortal beloved. So, in my own view, it is most likely that she was a woman as yet unknown to history. And perhaps eventually, when her identity is revealed, we could do another program on this side of Beethoven's life.
And I remember seeing the movie Immortal Beloved starring Gary Oldman as Beethoven. I've just looked it up now, checked it out. It's 26 years ago. It's
yes.
a very long time ago. But yeah, there is that interest. And that's one of the attractive things about Beethoven, that people are intrigued and fascinated by his life story, and they want to know more.
Of course they do. And part of that struggle that I mentioned earlier in his composition is his personality, his eccentricities, and the rumours and scandals that swirled all around him were present in his life when he was writing. They must have been a tremendous distraction. And yet all that is mitigated to a certain extent by the insights which the Heiligenstadt document and the Immortal Beloved letter give into how he really suffered from three main afflictions. One was his deafness. We know an awful lot about that. But then there was unrequited love, and many, many examples of that, because Beethoven fell in love very, very often. And the third one was, and he mentioned this very tellingly towards the end of his life, having no wife or children of his own. And that's what I meant when I said earlier that he was a lonely, isolated figure in many respects. And therefore, you could not say that he lost himself in his music, because he had to wrench the music from deep inside that world, which to him was his deafness. And he brought it out and he held it up and he said, he showed it to us and he said, "Listen to this. This is me." And I think that's what makes him so singular.
Very good. Thank you, George. Michael, it's something about the music that challenges you as a listener, doesn't it? And I think it challenges those who perform the works as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One work that I was hoping to introduce actually was a violin sonata of Beethoven's called the Kreutzer Sonata, which really grew out of, you know, the immediate visceral experience that Beethoven had playing with a brilliantly talented violinist by the name of George Bridgetower, who was a fascinating figure. Based in London by that stage, though, being born in Poland. He was actually of mixed race. His father was Afro-Caribbean from Barbados, and so he must have cut an extraordinary figure, and yet he was a brilliant player. And you can sense the intensity of their engagement in this sonata that Beethoven composed for him.
Thank you.
Simon, you can see or you can hear why Beethoven has been so much loved by filmmakers as well. And I'm even thinking of times when it's used in movies like The King's Speech, when Colin Firth's character, the king, is having to make this speech to inspire the British people during the Second World War. But at the climax of the movie, he delivers it. But they have Beethoven's slow movements for his Seventh Symphony playing in the background. And I always thought that's what elevated the speech. It wasn't the words. It wasn't how he delivered it. It was the power of Beethoven in the background. It is something. There is always something cinematic about it.
There is indeed, and the slow movement of the Seventh Symphony, actually, I remember from the film Zardoz as well. It's very evocatively used in that too. Yeah, I mean, it is a sort of universal music, and I mean, you open the program with the opening of the Fifth Symphony, which is perhaps the most universally recognized piece of music ever written, I would think. And you know, as a composer, perhaps he does stand as the universal figure for classical music. But that, in contrast, as has been referred to earlier, you know, the music can be very complex and difficult as well. But he was capable of writing very, very melodic, perhaps is the wrong word, but music that was quite light and attractive as well. He wasn't always doom and gloom by any means. There's plenty of the music that's very uplifting and very inspiring and very light and airy as well, coming from the Viennese classical tradition. So I suppose one doesn't want to paint the picture of this grumpy, difficult, cantankerous individual at all times in his music. I mean, like all of us, he was a complex character and capable of wit and elegance in his music, as well as doom and gloom and despair.
Very good. Wolfgang, we're almost out of time. I've chosen the final piece, one of my favourite Beethoven pieces. And I wonder, would you be able to assess Beethoven's impact and his legacy for us?
Yeah, he had an enormous impact on composers after him in many different respects. So people had to study his music. We know that Wagner, for instance, he is known only for his operas, really. He wrote little else. And that's partly because he said, well, Beethoven has done everything that can be done in the genre of symphony, which was one of the main genres in which you publicly expressed yourself. The way forward in music has to be what he then called the music drama. And he wrote about that. And on the other hand, Brahms, for example, 20 years or so struggled with writing a symphony because he said, you can't do something. It has to be better than was there was before. And Beethoven has done that as well. So only eventually, when he wrote his first symphony, 1874, it was then called Beethoven's 10th. It was accepted as such. But also in other areas, since the Kreutzer Sonata, Michael mentioned it, became the subject, indirectly so, of a novella by Tolstoy. And the impact in general culture, when the Berlin Wall fell, right a few days after the 9th of November 1989, Leonard Bernstein organized the performance of it, just where the wall was still at the time, and replaced the word Freude in German, joy, with Freiheit, freedom. So it became the ode to freedom, and it became the symbol of what had just happened there.
And that is indeed the piece of music we are going to play out with. And of course, it has also become the anthem of the European Union. But I thought we would play it out in part because of the power of the words. The words, of course, by Schiller, because in these days of darkness with the pandemic, I think the message of the Ode to Joy is particularly relevant. And the time will come when we will be embraced and drink of joy again. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Wolfgang Marx, Dr. Michael Lee, George Fleeton, and a special thank you to Simon Taylor, who is in the next few months going to be ending his period as chief executive of the National Concert Hall. Two superb terms, and I think we are all very grateful to him for the brilliant contribution he has made to Irish music. So thank you, Simon, and we will play out now with Ode to Joy. My thanks also to Susan Callum, my producer, Jojo on sound. We're back with more Talking History next week. Good night.
Talking History on News Talk.